Welcome to the Crystal Pain Show, where we help you embrace your life right where you are and give you practical steps to get where you want to go. Whether you are in your car, folding laundry, cooking, cleaning, or maybe even just enjoying a cup of coffee and a few minutes of quiet, we're so glad you're joining us today. Here's your host, wife, mom of six kids, foster mom, entrepreneur, and author, Crystal Pain.
Welcome to another episode of the Crystal Pain Show. We are talking about a topic that impacts pretty much almost everyone, whether you are married or want to be married, or whether you had parents, which everyone did, you're going to be able to resonate with what we're going to talk about today. And I think it's just such a vital topic. I was reading the book thinking, oh, being very convicted. I got my feet stepped all over in this book. So Rebecca and Gabe Lyons are in studio today. We're going to talk about their new book, The Fight for Us, Overcome What Divides to Build a Marriage That Thrives. And I love that you wrote this book together. And I can only imagine that some of the topics in this book came up in the process of writing this book, as in probably, I know at least if my husband and I tried to write a book, there would definitely be some differing opinions in the process.
I love your politically correct differing opinions. Yes, we even fought after our first conversation with our editor about how to write this book, which is just so funny because it's why this book feels so true to us, because we have historically both had strong opinions and passionate about things. And we just want to get honest about like the reality of the friction of marriage that sometimes scares us and makes us want to run, and how to instead, okay, go, what's going on below the surface?
Well, Crystal, thanks for having us on to talk about this, because it is a topic that I know when Rebecca and I ventured into this whole idea and prayed about, like, should we do this? Because it really puts ourselves out there. And if we're going to do it, we're going to be honest about our story and the hardest parts, the greatest parts, but we want to help people. And I think you're right and very intuitive. Like, as you start to write in any project you're writing, you learn a lot as you're writing, and you have to really clarify, oh, this is what I believe about this. You finally have to put it on paper and it's there forever. And so for us, that was part of the journey that could have been very divisive or disruptive. I would say for us, it became even more healing to stop and reflect on, oh, we've learned this lesson. Like, that's right. And that's that. Those are the principles we've been able to implement in our life that maybe would help some other couples too. And so I think we look back on the project now and we're like proud of it. It was hard, but it's been good. It's been really good. Even for our marriage, it's even strengthened us more to look back with gratefulness on all that we've walked through.
Yeah, it's kind of the reason I encourage journaling. You know, if you don't ever stop and pause and reflect on what has happened, you know, you sometimes can miss it or remember, you forget, you know. And so I think writing is a practice of remembering. And so even the act of going, wow, that was a pivotal moment. That's when things started to shift. And just having to have to write that account or that testament of God's kindness, you know, like our faith is a big part of just what kept us tethered. Even though there were tempting moments for all of us to just want to run and hide and retreat. But I just think that the practice of writing things down in general for anybody, whether you're publishing or not, is it's good for your brain, and it's good for you to look back, and it's good for you to be reminded of, you know, kindness, you know, the kindness that you have for each other.
I feel like your marriage started out with some hard things, like having your first child have Down syndrome. Like, that is a big thing as a couple to process through. And then you talk about, you know, you moved to New York City and, you know, you were trying to start this nonprofit, and there were just so many different things that I feel like could have really torn you apart. And so as you look back on that, and as you are writing this book, what would you say to the couple who is feeling like, I have so much that's just being thrown at me right now, life feels so overwhelming, and I don't know that we can make this?
Well, I think that's a real feeling every couple has, no matter how big the circumstance feels or little. Like, we have those moments in our life and in our marriage where you come to these crossroads and you do have to make this decision. Are we going to sort of become individuals and just try to figure it out on our own, or are we going to turn towards one another and we're going to fight together for what this ought to be and what it needs to be? You may know this as well, but you know, parents who have a child with Down syndrome are much more likely to get a divorce in their first year. If they make it through year one, they're more likely to stay together than other couples that have special needs children. It's just an interesting thing. Like Down syndrome is one of those particular special needs. In year one, you know it. You really have a vision and imagination because of what the world tells you that life's going to be like. That can be very lonely. It can also be challenging. It can make you kind of want to give up or go, I'm out. I don't want to do this. But couples who fight through that find a resilience. And I think for Rebecca and I, that was the gift at age 27 to be able to fight through one of those first moments. And I would say both of our lives that we'd had a pretty nice life, you know, hadn't had a lot of death happen around us. Like many, very few things had happened that were that challenging. And that was the one. Mm-hmm. And God used that to turn us towards one another. We're so thankful that we turned towards one another. It would have been easy not to.
Yeah.
But we had good community around us. We had people, parents that were encouraging us. And so we had a lot of benefits that I think some couples may not feel always right in those moments that helped us.
Yeah, that was just 3 years into our marriage. Mm-hmm. So we had said we would wait 5 years to have kids. We made it three. And then we found out 6 hours after Kate was born, the doctor said, we see signs of Down syndrome in your baby. So it definitely was not anything we were prepared for. And looking back, I'm okay with that. I actually think that, you know, God can meet us in the moment. And just give us what we need for that day. And that's what he did. And we had no choice. Honestly, the grace, I think, of hard things early on is that you're desperate enough that you feel like you don't have a choice but to turn toward each other. Mm-hmm. Like we're looking at each other like, you know, neither of us are going to be able to do this alone. Like we have to unite around this little guy. You know, he was failure to thrive. He went straight to the NICU, 4.5 pounds full term. At that point, we're just fighting for his life. The diagnosis was almost secondary initially. And I think a lot of parents, when they do have that baby, like they want to lean in. This is new life. But it's the stress, the elongated stress that all of a sudden can make marriages start to drift because they both process stress differently. Mm-hmm. And so part of the proactive step you asked earlier of like, what's some practical things for those who feel like this is really hard and I don't know if we can do this or make it, is to turn toward each other and just tell each other that. Sometimes we feel too much shame to go like, I feel inadequate, or I feel lonely, or I feel sad. I'm still grieving. And yet the whole point is like, if I just feel the freedom to tell Gabe that, then all of a sudden we can start to have a real conversation.
You talk early on in the book, you say fighting for our marriage requires focusing on the only person we can control, ourselves. The blame game ends when we finally have the courage to ask, what if the problem is me? That's really hard.
No, I mean, it's so easy to just, point the finger at the other person. I think that's very easy. I think it's encouraged in a lot of ways. Unfortunately, today, even in our therapeutic culture, where people are getting individual counseling, they're talking about all the things they're wrestling with. It's easy to just look at the other person and identify them and label them as the problem. It's in some ways like a scapegoat that gets us off the hook. And I think what we're encouraging couples to do, which we believe, you know, aligns deeply with our faith, is look inward first. Consider, how am I contributing anything that's not wonderful to this relationship? Whether it's my attitude, maybe it's cynicism, maybe it's sarcasm, maybe I'm just not showing up because I'm tired or I don't know how to show up. But to take account of what we can change, because that's the beautiful thing about a relationship. If one of us just makes a little bit of a change, the whole dynamic could change. And so we're trying to encourage couples. You're not going to change. I've never been able to change Rebecca. Trust me, there were things early in our marriage. I was like, I'd love to change this about her. I'd make her in my image, you know, to be the wife that I've always thought I would have. And the quicker you get over that pride and realize you're not going to change them. Like, we believe God's the one that ultimately can deal with that person and change them. So I've just got to focus on myself. And if I take proactive steps, I'm more confident. There's more meaning to that. I can do something that's proactive versus just wallow in this self-pity that things are so bad and it's always going to get worse.
Yeah. Taking that initiative is so huge. And honestly, even taking ownership of your emotions, like if I feel angry about, if I'm mad at Gabe, right? I'm just so frustrated, right? If I don't own that I'm harboring some level of resentment or bitterness or unforgiveness, I might even feel validated in saying those things because the way he acted.
She probably is validated, usually.
But in the end, I'm the one paying the price. Mm-hmm. Because I'm now like withholding myself from him. I'm hardened. I'm rough around the edges. I'm abrasive. I'm irritated. Like I'm easily irritated. The kids start to feel it. The fallout is with me. And so part of that is like owning even those positive and negative feelings or emotions that we are harboring towards one another. We could just start there. Like maybe that's, what if that part's me? You know, like you may not have even meant to like make me feel small in the statement that you said, because you just are like walking through your day. And how would you know that that hurt me if I didn't explain like, hey, maybe this wasn't your intention, but when you said X, I felt really small. I mean, guys, men and women are not wired the same. We're not thinking the same. Like we can personalize some things that they're just like, it's a Tuesday. They didn't even really mean that for harm at all. And so part of it's, again, coming back like, hey, I'm really mad at you.
Yeah.
And I know I'm not supposed to be, but I just need to be honest and like, let's talk about it.
We describe in the book these four dysfunctional dances that every couple could find themselves in. There's the avoidant dance, anxious dance, silent dance, and intense dance. And a lot of marriages, we have this quiz that everybody can take. Maybe we could link it here where they can see what is the dance you tend towards in your relationship when you start to get unhealthy. And the majority are intense and silent so far. All of our assessments, thousands of people are doing this. And the silent dance is the one I think a lot of couples are walking around with resentment, which leads towards a silent marriage. Like we get along, it looks good on the surface, because we essentially have buried these resentments. We don't want to address them. And so we live our lives tiptoeing around these things and never feeling fulfilled and trying to get that fulfillment outside the marriage, whether it's work or hobbies or
other
social
people.
Life. Yeah, other people, girlfriends, guy friends. And so our encouragement to people, once you discover what is the dance you tend towards, it's usually lopped into how you were raised, experiences you had that made you shut down emotionally. When you can take steps to acknowledge, hey, we're doing this dance, let's talk about why we do it. And let's together commit. We're going to come out of this dance. Yeah. We're going to get into a rhythm where we are able to express ourselves and talk honestly about any of the challenges in our way.
Yeah. So the silent dance is triggered by hurt, right? It's like these slow little resentments build up. The intense is triggered by anger, which makes sense, right? The avoidant is triggered by guilt. Just some level of like, this is a hard relationship. I'd rather come home a little later, or I don't want to have real conversations. I'm kind of withholding my heart at this point. I just don't want anything to blow up. So I'm just going to diffuse and just distance myself. And then the anxious one is fear. You know, it's triggered by fear and insecurity. Maybe the wife feels insecure about her looks or about his attention is going elsewhere. And he might feel insecure about how her spending is and he's trying to provide and where's all the money going and is he going to be enough to provide for the family? It can come from a lot of different things. But recognizing those triggers, again, go back to what is happening below the fight. And that's the point of this book. It's not just that you're fighting and then you're apologizing for your reaction. No, you're going, why? We got to get below the fight. What are we harboring? What are we feeling emotionally that we don't have words for that instead is coming out in the stress response?
Mm. That part of the book was really eye-opening to me because I realized I'm intense. My husband's avoidant. Mm. And it made so much sense when we have hard conversations, how we both approach it so differently. And it was really helpful to me, the practical steps that you gave to kind of understand that. And then I was like, oh, I need to slow it down.
Hmm.
I need to recognize that's the way that he's going to process things and give him grace for that. And also dig into, okay, where, you know, what's underneath how I'm approaching things and stuff. Mm. So it was really helpful to see that. You said, I think both of you are intense. Is that right?
Which makes for a lot of fighting. But when we took it separately, even after writing the book, we both are intense in the way we fight, but yours is a little more triggered by silence and then eruption. Mine is like an everyday intense. Like, where was that? How much did that cost? What did you buy? Where did you go? And he's like, wow, that's a lot.
Well, and we're too. It's funny. We were with some friends this weekend who we went to college with, and he was a counseling major, and he was recounting how he gave us an assessment when we were just dating. We hadn't gotten engaged yet. And he said, I gave you guys this compatibility assessment which I don't even remember this. And he goes, I remember because I took it to my professor and he looked at these two individuals he didn't know. And he said, man, that looks like trouble. They both are like crossing each other in a way that doesn't look aligned. And we both just laughed together and said, you know what? It makes sense that an assessment would have shown that we're both natural born, I think, leaders. We'd come from places that we both were driven. There was a lot in each of us that thought we knew the way forward. And when you get married, as you know, like you meet your match and you start to have to negotiate these things and it's humbling and you change. And so to be 28 years in and to laugh with them about like how God still, we had every reason not to work out. I think that's the point. Like yeah. we now have proof that when we were dating, we weren't the best aligned couple temperament.
It would have been a no-go in our premarital counseling from that professor probably.
But we did. And we're great, you know, and I just think that's encouragement. I hope to couples that feel misaligned or like, man, I married the wrong person or they're crazy or we just don't get along. We're not the best for each other. You actually can be, but it will require a fight. It will require commitment to turn towards one another and fight together versus fighting one another.
Well, and it has required what you were saying, this level of a lot of tears, you know, a lot of like almost discouragement or defeat. I talk later in the book about just resignation, like agreement with like, it is what it is. Or then worse going, I don't think I can do this. You know, a lot of people say those words out loud and it just becomes a slow slope of like, I'm out, you know? And I came close to that. And, but then because of faith, God's like, wait a minute, I didn't give up on you. You're not, why are you giving up on Gabe or giving up on you guys as a, like it's, even just to nurse that idea, I think can happen so in such a subtle way. And God, while he gave me, an intensity, he also gave me kind of this kind of vulnerability and confession. Like I'm kind of a chronic oversharer. I get it from my dad. And the good thing is that I couldn't nurse those thoughts too long without feeling the conviction to tell Gabe. Mm-hmm. And that's our big encouragement for marriages. Like if you're not talking, you're not healing. So having the courage to say the hard things, like I feel overwhelmed. I feel so discouraged. I feel defeated in this. Just keep coming back to that. And God used those opportunities to keep humbling us. So we're crying and then we're feeling so humbled by each other because we're, you know, sharpening each other, I guess. But in the end, that's kind of the point. The pruning of marriage is to kind of chip away all the ego and the pride and the persona that we've created when we're in a room of yes, people who will say yes to us. But when we're now confronted with our match that isn't leaving the room and they're not saying yes, we have to be confronted with like, okay, what in me needs to die? You know,
that's the encouragement to couples to talk. To start to talk about. And I think that's a huge step for people because they're like, it's too dangerous to talk. Maybe they'll leave me if I tell them honestly what I'm feeling. And that's where in combination with the idea of creating space to talk is also making a commitment. I'm not going to leave. And I think for couples today, that's a hard one to make because they're maybe in the back of their mind thinking, maybe I should leave. And they're hearing it from so many voices in social media, who they follow. They're seeing it in the culture, like leaving seems like a great option for people. If you're not satisfied, you'd be happier alone. Well, by the way, the data doesn't show that. We know that marriages are 560%. People who stay married long in life are 560% happier than those who are alone. Wow. So all the sociology actually points to a marriage, even when it's hard, being richer, more meaningful, and better for your life, for your health, for your financial stability, all these things. But we need to know that the other person's committed to not leave the room. And then there's a security and a safety to be honest. But if you feel like that person might leave or they've threatened it a lot, you're going to naturally just close up. You're going to be defensive because you're not sure it's safe. And so we need that safety and security inside of a marriage to move forward in health.
And it has to be mutual. Let's be honest. If one person is really fighting for this and they want to provide safety for the other person to share, but the other person's out, like I would just begin by going, it got unsafe because of both of you. right? It's not one person typically that makes it unsafe. Now, safe is a relative word. I'm not talking physical safety. I'm talking emotional safety, meaning that if Gabe, when Gabe started going to counseling years ago and he started saying, hey, I think I feel this towards you. And I'm like, wait a minute. And then I would defend myself and then not let him talk. And then all of a sudden he goes, and this is why I don't tell you anything, right? So men often will stonewall to diffuse. Whereas when a woman stonewalls, she's starting to shut off her heart. That's far more dangerous.
Whether your child is trying to catch up, stay sharp, or get a head start for the fall, IXL can make learning a seamless part of summer. IXL is an award-winning online learning platform that helps kids truly understand what they're learning. Whether they're brushing up on math or diving into social studies, it covers math, language arts, science, and social studies from pre-K through 12th grade with content that's engaging, personalized, and yes, actually fun. It's the perfect tool to keep learning going without making it feel like school. Silas used IXL in his math class a few years ago, and he really loved how he could work at his own pace, and he loved that he was able to see instant feedback on how he was doing. This program will improve your kids' grades. Studies show that kids who use IXL score higher on tests. It will work for any of your kids because IXL uses smart technology to tailor support to each child's level, personality, and learning pace, which I love. It also saves time because one subscription gets you everything. There's one site for all the kids in your home, whether they're pre-K up to 12th grade. And also, my favorite part, you save money because if your child is struggling, this is such a great investment. A single hour of tutoring costs more than a month of IXL. Don't miss out. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 96 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And Crystal Payne Show listeners can get an exclusive 20% off your IXL membership when you sign up today at IXL.com/today. Visit IXL.com/today to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
And so he was trying to come toward me and be vulnerable, but for me, it felt like an attack. So I would quickly interrupt and shut him down, which then quit the talking, you know? So then all of a sudden he's like, I'm just going to keep bottling it up. I'm going to internalize it. I'm not going to feel like I can share with her. And then I'm meanwhile wanting so much for him to come toward me and feel intimate, like emotionally with him. And I didn't realize I was the one shutting him down. In the same way, I would do the same. He would interrupt me before I even got the words out, defending why his action wasn't meaning that. And so that's why people have a hard time feeling safe both ways. We always go like our spouse isn't safe, but yet how many times have we interrupted and shut down or dismissed the things they tell us that might impact our behavior? It's a hard one.
You say in the book that in the world of psychology, there's a saying, if it's hysterical, it's historical. And I feel like so many issues in marriage, it feels like it's something on the surface, but it's so much deeper than that. And so how do we dig into those root things? Like, what are some basic first steps? I hear this from people a lot when I talk about, you know, we got to get to the root of an issue. They're like, well, I don't even know where to start.
Mm. Well, in section 2 of the book, there is a chapter called Your Origin Story. And we really believe that everyone has to go back. They have to go back. They have to consider their family of origin, their parents. How did their parents engage? Did one shut down the other? Was one more outsized in their opinion in the way they led the family? Was there any mutuality in the marriage? Or was it like one voice was heard and the other just kind of relented? Those are patterns that we grew up with. And we're going to adopt those things, even if they're never taught, they're caught. We're going to model and mimic what we learned. And so we went back to our parents' story and then their story, because it doesn't start with just your parents. It's like, what were their parents like? Did they actually give you more than they got? You know, look at what their deficit was. And we realized that our parents were born in the silent, they were part of the silent generation. Their parents were coming out of the war. Survival was at the all-time high. We had the Great Depression. Nobody was talking emotional health. Nobody was talking like, I feel lonely. It was more like, I want to have food on the table. We need clothes. We have no house. We have no shelter. People were rebuilding from nothing. And so they weren't equipped with like how to handle emotional health. It was just like, that was off the table for discussion. So that our parents slowly, they became the ones that like, well, we have to achieve and we have to get back on our feet and we have to work hard. And that was what dad did. Dad went out the door and worked countless hours to provide for the family, where the mom historically in that season would stay home with the kids right before women started to work more vocationally. So it all kind of makes sense that we're now in a new landscape where there's dual incomes in many homes. There are women who are also working in the workforce, but they're also raising kids, and men therefore are co-parenting more because it just like the rules are changing. And so part of that is recognizing like, oh, okay, well, I feel similar pressures that he feels, but I also need you to interject in like parenting and fathering our children in ways that I'm not responsible for. And so I think that origin was a big piece for us to understand.
And looking back to look forward is a key concept. You know, in therapy, that's a lot of what the conversation is, but it's not to look back to blame and be a victim. And I think that's the mistake people can make. They look back or they don't want to look back. I didn't want to look back because I'm like, I'm not a victim. Like, I'm moving forward. And every time I look back, that feels gross. That feels like I don't want to go there. Like, I've gotten past those pains. But the reality is, it's probably left some scars and left some marks that have impacted the way Rebecca and I relate, because it always goes through this lens of how I related to my parents or other adult leaders that broke trust with me, or all those kind of stories. And so I share that story in the book about my own journey through elementary and middle school and how I lost trust in relationships and did not want to be vulnerable anymore. And that led to Rebecca and I having to have some great conversations and asking God to just open my heart to some things that I had shut off and to be able to feel again in ways I didn't feel like I could feel. And the more I've talked to men, this tends to be common, that a lot of men who, to be successful in business, life, achievement, they've shut off part of their heart to achieve and to keep moving forward. And that works great in building a business sometimes. It can work great in achievement, maybe making a lot of money. It doesn't work great in your relationship with your wife. What works great with your wife is having this ability to slow that down, open your heart, be honest about what you're experiencing and feeling, and be able to hear her heart and be able to relate. And those took for me years of learning new skills, of having Rebecca's patience to walk with me through that. I'm still learning. I don't have it all figured out. It's a constant journey of growth to try to know how to hear one another and listen to one another and relate. But I'm thankful I looked back, because while I didn't want to, now I understand that without that, I would have been just a shell of who I am today.
Mm-hmm. And one thing I appreciate, y'all were so vulnerable in this book. Like, you just really open it up from the get-go. And I love that it's not like 20 years ago, this is a fight that we had. Like, it was very recent. And I think that that's so encouraging, because you have this great marriage. You're writing this book on marriage. You've been married for 28 years. Is that right? And yet you're saying, it's not like we have it completely all figured out.
No, I don't think we ever will. I mean, that's one thing we encourage marriages with, like, you can nail it like each decade, but then the next decade hits, right? Or every season. I think every shifting season of life creates new opportunities for conflict. Let's just put it that way. Whether you're birthing littles, or they're going off to kindergarten, or the mom's reentering the workforce, or she's staying home, or she's homeschooling, or you buy, or you sell, or you build a company, or you retire and then you launch your kids and then they come, you know, whatever it looks like. All these shifts and changes they're stressful. And so with stress, always, you just jump back into the dance. And so we're just being honest about that. But now we're better at recognizing it and going, oh, here we go. And it doesn't make me like go into this crazy hole of shame to where I'm like, we're never going to make it. You know, it's like, oh, this is actually kind of a normal, appropriate, but now I understand why we have this response. So we can quickly get to like, oh, I'm actually just feeling fearful, you know, or I'm sad. I'm like, we talk about the eight primary feelings in the book, how how if we could just recognize them and name them out loud, then all of a sudden with that emotion lifts, right? There's a gift that's offered with it when we don't feel it. Because I might be like, I'm sad. I miss our kids. They're in different states right now. I feel like part of them are, part of me is there. Mm-hmm. But just every season requires, every season will give you opportunity for conflict, but it also gives you opportunity to recognize it quicker and just be honest with where you at.
And husbands, that was a great example. She's feeling sad about our kids. So we tend to want to jump in and go, well, why don't we go visit them this weekend? Like, let's solve that problem for you. And what she's not needing is that. What she's needing is for me to recognize, no, you're sad, and I understand that you're sad, and it makes sense that you're sad because you long for them, you love them, you care for them, and to hold her in that. Mm-hmm. And for men, that's just really hard. We just want to help her be happy again, not feel sadness. I know, at least for me, because that makes me feel sad and uncomfortable, and I don't want to be uncomfortable. And so we try to fix it. But I'll also say about this book, you know, we don't have PhDs in marriage counseling, and we try to be very upfront about that. We have had the chance to walk with over 1,000 couples, though, through private retreats, through counseling, coaching, where couples that have come to us to learn, what have we learned? Because we've had several incredible counselors in our life over the last decade that have helped us walk this out in our marriage and learn so many of these skills. And, you know, the average person's having to wait almost a year to get good marriage counseling from a trusted marriage expert. And couples don't have that long to wait. When they start looking for counseling, they're already many times down the path to like, this isn't working. Mm-hmm. And so our hope is by just being honest about our story, being very vulnerable about our hardest times and hardest moments, that it would give couples some tools to start the conversation, mm-hmm. to begin the healing journey back towards one another, to have hope that this could get better. Because many times the couple loses hope. And they're waiting for that counseling session thinking that's going to bring the hope. And it doesn't often bring the hope right away. There's a lot of work to be done. And so we're hoping this can be a tool that just helps couples take those next steps towards healing.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you all a personal question. This is the for me personally, because the last few years probably have been the hardest for my husband and I in our marriage, with having a 20 down to 2-year-old and a child with special needs. Like, it's been a whole new journey for us. And I think I'd just love to get your wisdom. Like, we are just feeling like so often it's like two ships passing in the night. Mm-hmm. There's just so many different moving parts. And I know you guys have that. Mm-hmm. What wisdom? I know there are many other couples that probably feel that. Like, yeah. How do we keep our marriage strong?
Yeah.
And find the time for those conversations and to have that strong marriage in the midst of a very full life.
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that question. We write about this later in the book, where we were at year 19. So that was a good, almost 9 years ago. And we were about to bring our little girl Joy, who we were adopting with Down syndrome, home from China. And we were like, let's just do a tune-up. Like, we need to make sure that our marriage is intact. And it turned into like a 3-day intensive with our counselor. And he said something that was really eye-opening for both of us. He said, my concern with the two of you is that in like maybe in the next decade, your marriage might drift apart, that you guys would separate, not because of infidelity, but because you said yes to too many noble things. Mm-hmm. And he said, it's like you've bitten off a 10-pound cheeseburger and you're trying not to choke on it. And there is no capacity or margin for you to find each other. You are truly like roommates, your colleagues, you are your calendar, your cruise director. You are keeping all the ships afloat, but you have lost the desire even for intimacy because there's nothing left. And burnout is living from an empty place. There is no reserves left. And so, wow, we had to take that seriously and almost start planning a year in advance, going like, what are we saying no to? You know, like, we had already said yes to adopting Joy. That wasn't going to change. He's like, and now it's an 11-pound cheeseburger because you're bringing home this little girl. But all of a sudden, we did take a good hard look at our life and go, what do we really need? What are the tip of the arrow for the things we feel like God's entrusted to us to lead? And what are the things that we've just layered on top of that maybe were our idea, but aren't really good for the two of us. And so it has been an unraveling. Like, I feel like it's like, just we keep kind of laying things down, handing them over. And the gift of our relationship has it shows the fruit of that. Mm-hmm. But it took some intentionality to go like, I want to have these 15 minutes with you every day after work with no kids around, just debrief the day. I want us to have a Sabbath or a day where we're not producing something together where we don't have kids with us either. Like, yeah. It took a lot of carving out, but the fruit of it, like the benefit of it now is like game changer.
Yeah, we describe how a healthy marriage doesn't just happen. You have to structure it. And that doesn't sound romantic, doesn't sound like the way it's supposed to be, but trust me, it's the way it has to be in this world today. Like, we have to plan it. It needs to be on the calendar, like how we're having time together, whether it's a date or, you know, a Sabbath moment that we're committed to. We, as Rebecca said, I want to encourage couples who, like you, maybe you feel like you're right in the middle of the storm. You're like, I don't know how we're going to get out of this. Like, this is our life now. Is you do have to be patient with the process to say, hey, let's imagine a year from now. Like, let's just try to dream together. Let's take some pressure off of the moment. We're both committed. We've got travel next week and the next week and everything's planned. But a year from now, if we could change it a little bit, what would we change? How would we want life to feel? How would it be different? And that gives you some margin to dream again and then start to work backwards and go, well, let's start making decisions for next spring differently than we did this spring. And that allows, I think, the conversation around, how do we structure this? How do we start to build in the margin we're going to need to connect with one another? And I'll say for Rebecca and I, that's been a high priority throughout our entire marriage. We really have valued alone time where the kids are not right there. And that meant sometimes like, hey, we need an overnight. We don't have a lot of money. Like, we're going to go downtown Nashville and we're just going to get one night dinner, hotel, breakfast, and then we're going to come right back when school's over. And by the way, the sitter, we hardly know, but she's alive. She's breathing.
She came referred.
She has a phone number. And we've just always believed if her and I are connected, then that's going to help the kids feel even stronger. And okay. That's been our experience.
We did a little more R&D than he's giving away. We do. We don't leave our kids with like people that are sketch. We do ask for strong referrals, but they might be new to us, but we trust the people who they've worked with. But all that to say you do have to make it happen. And it has been such a gift. And we did a calendar audit years ago where this was kind of part of it. It's like, if you have X days a year and then X days a year where, you know, it's not weekends, like how many do you want just for the two of you? How many do you want as a family? And then work is last. And like, how do you make work be enough to, you know, to support you all? But, thinking of it that way, thinking of it in the value of relationships over things versus things over relationships, that shifted again. That made it easier to go like, huh, maybe we don't need that extra thing that we thought we did, because now we got what we started to do. Because you would resonate with this. You know, if you have kids with different abilities and have needs all weekend long, sometimes it's easier for us to take like 6 hours on a day that's unproductive on a Thursday because they're all in school and they have caregivers.
I think like you talking about, even though it was funny about, you know, not knowing the caregiver perfectly or whatever, but I think as moms, sometimes we stress so much about like, do they check every single box? And then I can not go have the date because I'm so worried about, are my kids going to be okay? Mm-hmm. And to recognize that actually me making sure that my marriage is okay, even if maybe it isn't the most 150% excellent babysitter situation, like they're safe, you know, that was just really encouraging to me because right now our childcare situation isn't always like, I have that feeling of like, I mean, it's okay, but you know, and so then I'll talk myself out of having a date night because I'm like, I don't, this isn't perfect. And I just
thanks for acknowledging that. Cause I talk to husbands all the time who they're dealing with this. They're dealing with their wife who just wants to make sure their child's okay. Maybe they had a baby and it's been a year and they haven't been on a good date. They haven't had this quality time. And the husband needs that. He needs to know he's more important than that child. Mm-hmm. And even if in your heart you're like, he's not as important. I know how moms are. It's like, no, actually my child feels more important. Your husband needs to feel more important. Mm-hmm. In these moments to know that you're willing to like take the risk and be fully present, not constantly worrying about it, but trusting God, like he cares more for your children than you do. And he wants me to honor my husband. He wants me to have this time for just the two of us. So you keep that fire cultivated, which will go so far, you know, in the weeks after that.
Yeah. A child's security is actually dependent on the relationship of their caregivers, right? Their parents. Like, a child is going to feel more secure knowing mom and dad like each other and they laugh and they have fun and there's like a levity or an ease to the relationship, which can only happen from like some time away from kids. I think women get so intense because we are always vigilant. Like, we haven't like, well, hey, I have no responsibility right now. I mean, Gabe and I, we first went away after Cade was born. Thankfully, it was your parents at the time watching him. It was like our baby moon with Pierce. I was like, we've had uninterrupted conversations for 3 days and we've laughed and I don't have to cook for anybody. I don't have to worry about, you know, I think that helps women be less intense because we just get in this vigilant cycle that we can't ever let down because everything depends on us. And as you and I both discussed, like, we can both tend toward that. So knowing that, all the more I go, I got a structure in play. Mm-hmm. I have permission to play. I want to laugh out loud. My kids will see a better mom coming back from that. And then they'll be like, oh, I feel good because mom and dad are happy. I'm happy. Like, the house feels more stable for our kids, even though it feels like it's costly to leave them.
Mm-hmm. That's so powerful. There's so much more we could talk about. There's so much more in this book. I did want to read, I mentioned earlier about the if it's hysterical, it's historical, but you went on to say something I thought that was really powerful as we close this out. You said, when our reaction is disproportionate to the issue, only 10% of our reaction has to do with the current issue itself. This means 90% of our response is triggered by something in our past. And I just really appreciate how in this book, you're not giving these band-aids for people to put on their marriage, but really encouraging them to dig into what are those deep things in their past. Maybe it's wounds, it's trauma, other things that, you know, they just haven't processed, learned good, healthy responses. Mm-hmm. And I think that is what is really going to change marriages, is when we deal with our emotional health and our spiritual health, and we dig into the deep stuff so that we learn to actually respond out of a place of health. That is just a gift that we're going to give our spouse, but also our kids, our grandkids. Like, it's going to change our legacy. And so this book is so powerful, and I'm just so excited to get to apply it in my own life, but also to hopefully have so many people who are listening pick up a copy and help them encourage in their marriage. Rebecca and Gabe Lyons, this book, everyone needs to read it. The Fight for Us, Overcome What Divides to Build a Marriage That Thrives. And also, it's a really easy read too. I appreciate that. You have a lot of stories. It's very relatable, and it just feels like, oh, like they get me. Mm. Like, they've experienced the things that I've experienced. They're not standing up on this pedestal and making me feel like, you know, what's my problem? But you're just really honest and open in the book. And I just really appreciate that. So thank you for writing it. We'll link to it in the show notes. Mm.
Thank you, Crystal. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for joining us today. For more great resources, please visit crystalpayne.com.